Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the 28 pages from the Joint Congressional Investigation into the 9/11 attacks that were classified by President George W. Bush, which now to some extent implicate the Bush family friend Prince Bandar, who was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States at the time of 9/11. Veteran CIA officer Robert Baer, the author of Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, who is now the national security analyst for CNN, joins us to discuss the contents of the declassified documents that detail contacts between some of the 9/11 hijackers and Saudi officials, as well as efforts by the Saudi government to thwart U.S. efforts to combat al-Qaeda before the 9/11 attacks. Then we will speak with Asla Bali, the director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at UCLA, who was born in Turkey and has family in a country on edge after a failed military coup that the country's autocratic President Erdogan has described as a gift from God, which he is now taking advantage of with a vengeance as he rounds up thousands of military officers and judges in a purge that will accelerate his increasing power grab from what was a slow coup before the botched overnight attempted coup by elements of the military who claim to be acting in the name of democracy. Then finally, we'll look into the absurd amateur theatrics surrounding Donald Trump's pick of Mike Pence as his running mate, with Pence getting wind that Chris Christie was weighing in on Trump to pick him. So Pence went ahead and leaked to the press that he was the chosen VP, which infuriated Trump, who then had buyer's remorse and second thoughts, which Christie then leaked to the press in the hope that the decision could be reversed. Marjorie Hershey, a professor of political science at Indiana University, whose research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, joins us to discuss the unseemly ambition of Indiana Governor Mike Pence and his desperate vice presidential rivals, Chris Christie and Newt Gingrich. Joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He is one of the foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And there was a story, I think it's still up at the Huffington Post, that's critical of you in terms of the coverage that you were doing live on CNN as the botched coup unfolded through the night in Turkey on Friday night. And it was an odd criticism because it said that you, as a former CIA officer, were trying to give the coup plotters advice live on CNN, as though the coup plotters would be watching CNN, because presumably...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure that's what they were doing. They're sitting in their tanks watching CNN, waiting for some CIA guy who hasn't been in 20 years, say, hey, look, here's how you do it. And, it's whoever wrote that article clearly hasn't read Turkish modern history, which is just filled with coups. I mean, it was a military, junta for years and years, and if anybody knows how to carry off a coup, it's the Turks. And of course, this was just a colonel's coup, and it wasn't the whole army, and even the rank and file weren't very supportive of it. I mean, I've got contacts in the military, but anyhow, the last thing you can do is give advice to the Turks on something like this. So it was pretty silly. But that's what worries me about the media, and we're getting to Saudi Arabia, is how silly it's becoming. Because if you read those 28 pages on Saudi complicity in 9/11, at some level, let me add, how you can look at that as an exoneration, I don't get.
Well, it's sort of been prepped that way, hasn't it? I mean,
It was prepped by the president. It was prepped by some members of the commission. And, of course, John Brennan, the CIA director, who, by the way, used to serve in Saudi Arabia and is very close to the royal family. So I don't pay much attention to that. But for me, what's very important is to place that 28 pages along with the so-called intelligence we used to attack Iraq in 2003. Or even equally blaming the Iranians for all sorts of terrorism. I've seen all the intelligence on their connection with the hostage taking. And trust me, the intelligence against Saudi Arabia involvement in 9/11 is much, much, much stronger. I mean, you just look at the calls. And what also bothers me is, you know, the Saudis just sandbagged the investigation. Well, there's documents out there saying that, you know, investigators went out there. They simply denied things that we knew to be fact, like calls between the Saudi consul in Los Angeles and, you know, the guys who met the two hijackers when they arrived. I mean, I think the important thing really is the investigation of Saudi Arabia stopped, and many of the commissioners have said this. They just decided not to look into it. We didn't want to know.
Well, but that decision, it looks as though, in terms of declassifying the 28 pages, that was made by President George W. Bush. And the connections between the Bush family and Prince Bandar bin Salman, who was then the Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Washington and was a very well-established figure there, that is pretty extraordinary, given that these 28 pages reveal that Prince Bandar and his wife, Princess Haifa, gave $74,000 in cashier's checks to Osama Bazanan, who was considered to be even a friend of bin Laden's and a huge supporter of al-Qaeda. And it looks as if he was the guy that financed those two hijackers down in San Diego.
Ian, that's a matter of record. I mean, he met him in Culver City, drove him down, put him up in an apartment, excuse me, found a fixer for him. I mean, this is material support for terrorism. We obviously don't know what Bazanan knew, because he's not talking. He was not made available to talk to the FBI or investigators. I just find the whole thing extraordinary. And going back to George W. Bush, let's not forget where he made his money. It was Harkin Energy, which had a fraudulent field in Bahrain, anything to do with oil is connected to the Saudis. That's how he got his money to get in the Texas Rangers. So he's beholden to Saudi Arabia sort of for every penny he has. I just find the whole thing extraordinary. And what I do find more extraordinary is Americans just aren't up in arms, or the families of the soldiers that lost their lives in Iraq, that were told that Saddam Hussein was behind. And, of course, there isn't a shred of evidence that Saddam knew anything about it or supported it in any way. But the neocons in the White House, you know, they didn't care about the facts.
And, of course, Prince Bandar directly wrote a $15,000 check to Bazanan from his own bank account in Washington. And of course, these 28 pages also indicate that the Saudi government did a lot. I mean, this is the Al Saud family, effectively. It's a family government. Did much to thwart American attempts to combat al-Qaeda in the years before the attacks. And then you've got the connections between Abu Zubaydah, the guy that was waterboarded 85 times, I believe. He had phone contacts with the people who ran Prince Bandar's estate up in Aspen, and also one of his bodyguards. These phone numbers showed up on Abu Zubaydah's phone, and there's also a Saudi naval officer who plays a role, a rather mysterious one as well. It's that when they say this was just raw field notes. But we don't know. Sure, they were raw field notes, but they're pretty incriminating on the surface. The whole point of them was they all had to be run down. Were any of these leads run down?
No. I mean, there's nothing in the 9/11 Commission. The commissioners have said, several of them, that we were stopped from pursuing Saudi Arabia. And when they were waterboarding Abu Zubaydah, trust me, they were not asking about why did he have these numbers. I mean, you know, so much of this stuff, the initial reports are wrong, but the only way to correct them is to go through the data, investigate it, release the metadata on the calls between the Saudi consul and Bayoumi, another suspect in this, and just make it public. These aren't secrets. I mean, it's not even an ongoing investigation. You know, the FBI may say it is, but in fact, nobody's pursuing it. And, you know, to go back to the $15,000 check, if you or I wrote a check to anybody involved in murder, we'd be in jail.
Well, this is mass murder, then.
It's mass murder. I mean, I just find it incredible. I mean, frankly, I don't know if the royal family or who knew was involved in it. I just find that'd be very shocking if the king of Saudi Arabia or Bandar himself. But the point is, unless they offer up explanations and deal with the facts as we know, we'll never know who in Saudi Arabia was involved.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who is one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history, winner of the Career Intelligence Medal, the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Now, one would hope that the release of these 28 pages would focus the country on a reckoning about its relationship with Saudi Arabia. This is a country that has that propagates a very anti-Western, xenophobic, aggressive and hateful version of Islam that they've spread around the world with vast amounts of petrodollars, opening up mosques, sending preachers around, and we know. Of the direct connections to this ideology that has spawned al-Qaeda, al-Shabaab, the Taliban, Boko Haram, and, of course, the current ISIS or Islamic State. The extraordinary thing is that the boy king now running Saudi Arabia has made a point of moving to his palace in the very province of Saudi Arabia where the Wahhabi sect was born. And where, by the way, I think at least nine of these 9/11 hijackers were recruited from.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's like, all right, somebody in Saudi Arabia put those 15 hijackers on a plane and paid for their tickets. At the very least, I'd like to know who did that and why. What did they think when they were buying tickets for them? This isn't like Encounters of the Third Kind where a spaceship, you know, lands and everybody gets on. It just... there's a network there. There's absolutely a network there, and no one's been forthcoming on that, in particular the Saudis. It's either because they were complicitous in 9/11 at some official there, or they just don't want to know. In either case, they're clearly not our ally against terrorism.
But the reason that they recruited from the hardcore Wahhabi area, they recruited essentially illiterate, uneducated people who hadn't been abroad before, seems to be to do with the Wahhabi ideology, which is the only way to explain the logic, or if that's the right word, behind the 9/11 attack, which was religious apocalyptic fervor.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The Wahhabis and the preachers are very, very fanatical, and they create the basis for this. But I think we should get to the very important answers, the detailed ones, of who in Saudi Arabia precisely, supported this attack, because clearly somebody did. And even the 9/11 Commission report's findings were that we don't have any evidence that the leadership was involved, but somebody in Saudi Arabia was. But then that begs the question is who? And are they still out there? And what are they planning next?
Well, little wonder that people in this country are suspicious, contemptuous, and feel completely alienated from the U.S. government, and many of them are turning to demagogues like Donald Trump. They're right. Their government does
they're
lie to
absolutely
them.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, Trump wouldn't be my vessel for political change in this country, but when he sits, you know, when he tells us about the Iraqi war that was based on a fraud, he's absolutely right. And at least somebody, you know, cutting through the fog is an appeal to Americans. It's just like the housing collapse in 2008 and 2009. People don't know precisely, they don't understand. I don't understand derivatives. But they do understand that they were taken for a ride and lost their houses, 2 million people. And, of course, when somebody starts telling the truth, they become attractive, as opposed to the set we have in Washington that just don't want to deal with it.
or in this case of the 28 pages, have actively covered it up.
And they still did actively cover it up. It's, I mean, when the commissioners come out and say, no, this is, it was covered up, I believe them. When Layman comes out, very serious man, he's part of the establishment. When he says that Saudi Arabia, its role was covered up, I believe him. He's not. He's not a man that entertains crazy conspiracy theories. Nor Senator Graham. I know them. They just don't. So I mean, this thing should be reopened, reinvestigated, and if we're wrong about these facts in the 28 pages, the American people deserve to say, "Listen, we checked this out, and here's why it's wrong." But they're not doing it.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with veteran CIA officer Robert Baer, who is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Turkish-born specialist on Turkish politics about the failed military coup, which is basically been a gift to President Erdogan, who described the coup as a gift from God. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And she's also the director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at UCLA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And I understand that you, since you've got family in Turkey, you're deeply concerned about what is happening in the country, as I think most people are. And there's a kind of a rather looming sense of dread here that now that President Erdogan has referred to this military coup as a gift from God to him, there's an expectation that this will bolster his power and that he may well be quite ruthless and unyielding in his vengeance here. So is that what we are to expect?
I think that's correct. I think there's no reason to expect anything less than a complete consolidation of Erdogan's power and the accomplishment of his goals of the last few years, which is the aggregation of power and its centralization in the executive and more specifically in his office. That's already been something that's been underway as a de facto matter since he was elected as president. We've watched 2 years during which we have basically shunted aside the parliamentary system in the country and delegated most authorities up to the president's office, which prior to his election had been much weaker office, which had some real powers, but we were in a parliamentary system unlike, say, the U.S. or France, in which real power resided with the prime minister. Indeed, Erdogan was that prime minister. But since he has assumed the presidency, that has been radically altered. But he has wished to see constitutional changes and legislative changes that would render de jure what he has done de facto. And he has met some resistance. That resistance, I think, will no longer be possible in Turkey. So I think what we can expect is a period in which first we see what's already underway as of today, about 6,000 people, 3,000 of whom from the military, have been detained, and thousands of judges have been removed from office over, and close to 3,000 there, 2,745 judges have been removed from office. We've seen the two of the justices of the Turkish Constitutional Court detained, 140 other senior judges from the highest appellate courts detained. So, you know, under these circumstances, I think what we're witnessing is the dismantling of whatever institutional checks remained on Erdogan's power, and it is being justified, as it has been, actually, for the past couple of years, in terms of conspiracies, internal enemies, the need to have power concentrated in order to effectuate the changes that he and his party believe are necessary to put Turkey on the footing, both economically and politically and militarily, that they believe is best for the country. And they no longer think that they need to consult with any other faction in the country as to what those changes ought to be. And this set of events has made it possible for them to basically sideline not only institutions, but any other form of opposition. I think it's going to be very difficult to engage in to engage critically, to engage in dissent, to engage in open opposition to Erdogan's plans in Turkey. And it's conceivable to me that the sort of crackdown on dissent and opposition is something that it will take at least a generation to undo.
And, of course, firing at least 3,000, if not more, who knows how many by the time he's finished, from the judiciary, and you just mentioned it, at the highest level of the judiciary with the equivalent of the Supreme Court. I mean, it's hard to believe that thousands of judges were involved in a secret military coup. There's a level of absurdity to these charges, and it's clear that this is an excuse for a massive purge. But what is this obsession that Erdogan has with the Gulenists? I mean, clearly they were allies of the AKP, and they are against the military and in favor of much of what Erdogan is doing and has been doing. So what is the basis for this idea that in the midst of all of this military coup and chaos in Turkey, here you have the president of Turkey accusing the United States of harboring the person who is the coup plotter. And you've got Secretary of State Kerry saying, wait a minute, you know, give us the evidence. You've got high-level officials in Turkey essentially accusing the United States of being behind this coup.
Yeah, that's right. Well, to begin with, those kinds of conspiracy theories that point to the United States as an explanation of political developments in Turkey are par for the course. That's not exclusive to the AKP, although it is very rare to see cabinet ministers making these kinds of accusations, as we have over this weekend in Turkey. I try to explain the Gulen movement to Americans who are familiar with legal education and the courts in America by comparing it to the Federalist Society. This is a movement that basically explicitly made a decision some 30 years ago, maybe 40 years ago, to commit resources and build an educational network that would provide scholarships and otherwise support students that shared their views, which are, you know, sort of moderate Islamists from the Sufi or inspired from the Sufi tradition, and conservative nationalist, progressivist in the sense that they are very focused on science and technology and so on, and basically enable a swath of the Turkish society that had previously been excluded from access to state resources and state power to succeed in civil service exams, to basically join the ranks of the bureaucracy of the state in order, on the one hand, to raise themselves up into the middle class, and on the other hand, in order to shift the direction of that bureaucracy ideologically. So that's exactly what the Federalist Society set out to do here, you know, aggregate monies to give scholarships to basically advance a generation of Republican youth through law schools so that they would be well positioned to join the federal judiciary. That's what civil society does. If you have, you know, a set of viewpoints that you believe have been excluded, and you decide that you want to build a network and devote the resources to enable education and advance, you know, a swath of society into different state positions, that's, you know, in an ordinary democracy, something that can easily be done. And the way in which people have responded to that in the United States is by Democrats sort of belatedly organizing similar efforts, building the American Constitution Society, and you essentially just have different factions in civil society doing their best to provide scholarships and education in order to see their viewpoints advanced in the political spectrum. In Turkey, this is seen instead as a kind of vicious underground effort to take over the state. And for a very long time, people associated that effort with the AKP and its success. And so they believed that there was this stealth sort of project, Trojan horse project of getting people in and then essentially controlling the state from within. And the AKP, as you mentioned, and Gulen were close partners insofar as they shared the view that a long disenfranchised proportion of the population in Turkey could now not only be enfranchised and represented, but also become full participants in state resources and in the civil service, by which I mean the regular bureaucracy of the state and also the security sector, police, the judiciary, and so on, areas that all had been within the sort of exclusive purview of the secular Western elite of the country up until basically the 1970s. That project turned on Erdogan in 2013 when Gulen increasingly, I think, felt that the direction that the AKP was taking under Erdogan's leadership was veering away from democracy, was engaging in foreign policy adventurism that he disapproved of, and so on. And this came to the fore in the guise of a corruption investigation where, at least on the AKP's telling, Gulen-associated prosecutors and judges initiated an investigation against the sort of inner circle of the AKP, Erdogan and his sons and others, son-in-laws and others, and basically incredible amounts of evidence emerged of real wrongdoing, corruption, and so on. Erdogan's response to this was to declare that this was an attempted judicial coup, to purge the judiciary and prosecutors, to do a complete U-turn on reforms that had just recently been put in place by his own party to enhance the independence of the judiciary. He immediately turned on those institutions. He basically devastated them through detentions and removals and demotions and sending of independent and experienced prosecutors and judges to remote provinces and away from the major cities and so on. This began in 2013. So the kind of coup that Erdogan himself has been undertaking against independence of the judiciary in Turkey has been now ongoing from 2014 to today. The corruption scandal emerged November, December 2013. And from that time, he has accused the Gulen movement of representing basically a parallel state or a state within a state would be a way that maybe your listeners would better understand the claim. And he has been systematically seeking to purge them and anybody who is within their circle of influence out of the bureaucracy of the state, the security services, the intelligence, the military, the judiciary, and so forth. The scale of the claims of how many people allegedly are in this network is fantastical and almost impossible to believe. For starters, immediately after these events and when the state openly declared war on the Gulen movement, there were local elections and then the presidential election, and there was absolutely no evidence that Gulen was able to affect more than 1% or so of the electorate. The outcomes were favorable to AKP. If this was a sprawling network with incredible tentacular influence everywhere and millions of adherents, you would have expected there to be some impact of this massive attack by the state on this, supposedly shadowy network, and we really didn't see that kind of a significant electoral role, and people were surprised by that because there had long been conspiracy theories about exactly how influential Gulen's networks were in the country, and they really had almost no impact on those elections. 3 years down the line, with as many purges as have happened, the likelihood that there's a significant Gulenist organization within the state at all seems to me extremely unlikely. Moreover, the state has now, and the AKP, and especially Erdogan, has come to identify anybody that they view as with suspicion, anybody who might be mildly critical, anybody who might have a, basically independent viewpoint as Gulenist. So it's become just, a word that means everything and anything that the AKP dislikes. And so it's a way to basically purge anybody that's deemed not adequately loyal. And we recently saw, as you may know, what was perceived internationally and domestically as an extraordinarily loyal prime minister swept aside on the grounds that he wasn't adequately subservient, with elaborate conspiracy theories, again, about him and his intentions in May, although those events now, of course, have been completely superseded by the subsequent events of this weekend. But in any case, I mean, there's been a roiling situation now in Turkey for years in which supposed internal enemies, many of them named members of this Gulen network, but which is just very difficult to believe, implausible sort of elaborate claims of this broad conspiracy within the country, has been used to purge all of the branches of government. So when Erdogan then says this is a gift from God. And basically he's saying this attempted coup confirms all of my claims about a conspiracy afoot against me and my government that's being run out of Pennsylvania by this exiled cleric and the capacities of his network, and allows me free hand now to engage in much wider purges, much greater detentions. He's talking about reintroducing the death penalty. And in the midst of all of this, what we're actually going to see is, as I've already said, the dismantling of any remaining autonomous institution in the country and anything that might have represented a check specifically on Erdogan's personal ambitions and more generally on the strict majoritarian mechanisms through which the AKP now governs, which have very little relationship to democracy or democratic institutions, other than the fact of elections and being able to produce 50 or 51% of the electorate in elections.
And again, I'm speaking with Asla Bala, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And she is the director of the Center for Near East Studies at UCLA. So when you make an analogy between the Golanist and the Federalist Society, surely in terms of Erdogan, you can make analogies with Putin. Putin was both, he was the president, then he was the prime minister, and then he became president again. He's basically eviscerated the judiciary and totally subjugated them. And also there seems to be some analogies with Donald Trump, in as much as Donald Trump is going after the sort of rural, uneducated, religious vote. He has a massive ego, and his, in many ways, his business record is all about family enrichment. So what's happening to the world with the Putins, the Trumps, the Erdogans, the Netanyahus, all of these right-wing, swashbuckling populists seem to be taking over?
Yeah, you might add Narendra Modi to that list. Mm-hmm. Yes, in various, I mean, with some obviously important distinctions as well in terms of the degree to which each of these is operating in a setting where there remains some institutional checks. I mean, most obviously Donald Trump, even were he to be elected president, would face a very different political configuration and institutional configuration in this country than what at least Putin or Erdogan have faced in their time as they rose to power and then concentrated power in the ways that they have. But yeah, I think that you're right that what we're witnessing is the rise of a kind of lurching to the right, and that it is not at all confined to any region or particular part of the world, and nor is it confined to places that we're typically accustomed to thinking of as the developing world. We're seeing this same trend in the West. And as you point out, Donald Trump is an example, but some of the kind of demagoguery and populism that was appealed to in the Brexit context, Putin himself, who is as much a Western figure as anything. I mean, it's a very disturbing set of trends, and I think there are a number of structural factors that probably can be connected, some of them having to do with financial crisis, which obviously was a much more significant, I mean, Russia faced a level of financial crisis and economic structural insecurity that was far greater than and in advance of any financial crisis in the rest of the world, but the consequences of the financial crisis and the ways in which it was handled and the mass anger that it produced is part of the explanation, I think, in the West. And in Turkey, as I've already said, I mean, there are very legitimate grievances amongst a very wide swath of the population that they were historically excluded both from access to state resources and really from any form of privilege in the country, even meaningful representation. And the AKP has done a lot of things that rightly would motivate much of that electorate to continue to support them. Everything from just the basic fact of the Gini coefficient having gone down in this period and inequality having gone down, the extension of national health infrastructure that means that people are able to get meaningful health care in the country at very low cost is in and of itself transformative of people's lives, the opening up of the educational sector, the opening up of the civil service. I mean, all of these things have been important. Some of them are not attributable to the AKP directly. For example, the creation of the national health infrastructure and insurance systems and so on were things that were put in place by their immediate predecessor, but the AKP did not reverse course, in fact, accelerated on many of those reforms. And for a whole decade, basically, in office, they did many things that would rightly be celebrated as democratizing, as certainly enfranchising large swaths of the Turkish population, which arguably constitutes a majority, that now vote in their interest. they're not voting counter-interest. They are voting in their own interest because they understand that their economic futures are tied to the AKP. Now, obviously, if Erdogan drives the country to a precipice where there is a massive impact on the economy, as has arguably been the case this year between the combination of Islamic State attacks and the war that's being prosecuted by Erdogan against the Kurds in the southeast, then things might start to shift. And what's interesting about the timing of the attempted coup is that, in fact, Erdogan has brought the military on side in terms of its own institutional interests with this war in the southeast. I mean, these are generals who are now once again able to give press conferences and point to maps and describe their operations and so on and return to a basic foundational principle of Kemalism. I mean, they're often described as a Kemalist bastion, a guardianship of the military, which obviously after the events of this weekend can no longer be spoken of seriously. But when people speak of the military as Kemalist, especially in comparison to the AKP, they almost always are emphasizing secularism. But actually, the probably much more important element that the military represents is ethno-nationalism of Kemalism, and that is very tied up with a paranoid view of the Kurdish community and of alleged separatist tendencies and so on. And in light of the success of Kurdish factions in Syria in securing some degree of autonomy for enclaves that directly border on Turkey, both the AKP government, but especially the military, have been deeply unnerved by what the implications of that might be. And that is in part an explanation of this war that's been declared on our southeastern provinces with martial law and curfews and, widespread attacks on, major urban infrastructure in central parts of the cities in the southeast. And that has brought the military into a partnership and collaboration with the AKP. So to view the military as a separate pole or as necessarily institutionally opposed, or this coup, attempted coup, as evidence that the military and the AKP have been on a collision course, I think would be a misreading, which is partly why the attempted coup would have failed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Asla Bali. I'm sorry it's under these conditions, but I hope your family is safe in Turkey.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And she's the director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at UCLA. Yalan, başkası yalan. Dünyada ölümden başkası yalan. Yalan, başkası yalan. Dünyada ölümden başkası yalan. But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, the Major Political Parties Text, now in its 17th edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you very much.
And the governor of your state of Indiana, of course, has been chosen by Donald Trump, but not without a kind of combination of soap opera and amateurism. When Donald Trump finally introduced Mike Pence to the world, he spent about 20 minutes to a half hour talking about himself, and then it was as though he sort of said, oh, by the way, here's this guy that's now my vice president. They bring this Pence on. But the background to it is pretty extraordinary. Let's start with the first piece of strangeness, and that was that Trump's plane, apparently, when it landed in Indiana on a campaign stop, it blew its tires out, which meant that Trump was spending a lot of time with Pence while they fixed the tire on the plane. And Newt Gingrich got wind of this, and Sean Hannity of Fox News lent or paid for a private jet to fly nude out so that he could distract Trump so that he wasn't going to spend too much time with Pence. So what is going on here?
I had gotten calls on Wednesday from some reporters who said that there had been a Gingrich sighting in Indiana that morning, and were asking whether or not this made a difference. I was sort of envisioning people wearing Newt Gingrich masks being planted around the state. Well, I think it's clear that this was an odd set of choices. One of the things that you wouldn't expect from a presidential candidate who was at that point 5 days away from being in the nominating convention by his party would have a range of choices so varied for his vice presidential candidate. I mean, Governor Pence is clearly identified with the evangelical wing of the party. Chris Christie is clearly not identified with that wing, nor is Newt Gingrich. And it struck me at the time that this was a pretty good indicator that the Trump campaign still really doesn't have a clear sense of where it plugs into the Republican base, if it does at all. They were still casting around as to what they ought to do, whereas as far as the Clinton campaign is concerned, it seems as though the considerations at this point are mainly tactical. If they choose as vice president somebody who is a member of the Senate but is a Democrat from a state in which there's a Republican governor, then the Republican would appoint his or her replacement, and that would make it more difficult for the Democrats to regain a majority in the Senate. So it just struck me the remarkable difference between the two campaign situations at that point.
Well, of course, in addition to that, it's pretty clear that a number of Republicans have run away from Trump. The most awkward of all was when Senator Corker was on stage with him and just simply didn't know what to say. He's had a number of rejections, has he not?
Oh, I believe he has. And it doesn't surprise me that Governor Pence was not one of those, because when he first became governor, at the beginning of his term, he was widely understood, even by Republicans in the State House, as having very little interest in state government. It just seemed clear that he was gone a good part of the time, and that his primary concern was that he wanted to become president, and being governor was a stepping stone to that, he felt. And then when he became reengaged a bit later in his term, that was when the trouble got substantially worse. He became very involved in and was a big promoter of the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana, which would have given businesses and anybody the right to refuse service to anyone on the grounds of their religious beliefs, and was strongly opposed by an awful lot of business people, bigger business people. Their concern was that their ability to recruit new executives from out of state would really be hampered by this if Indiana developed the reputation as a state of its intolerance, especially toward gay people, and that prospective executives, whether or not they were gay, would be very worried about moving their families into a state where their kids would be in schools where they might be taught religious intolerance. So the governor immediately put himself into a firestorm, and he insisted that this was not at all directed against the gay population. But then in a signing ceremony from the bill, which was not a public signing ceremony, he had behind him arrayed a whole bunch of religious figures, many of them having made previously intolerant statements. And as a result of that, there was a big controversy over the legislation. The legislature, which was very overwhelmingly Republican, decided to pass what was referred to as a fix that would have made it a little bit less draconian, a piece of legislation. And what happened after that was that poor Governor Pence was regarded as a traitor by the evangelical community because he had allowed this so-called fix to be passed. And at the same time, we had some pretty notable infrastructure failures in the state. There were failures of bridges. There were roads in very bad condition. So the perception was that Governor Pence was very concerned about making sure that people could discriminate against gays if they chose, but that he wasn't particularly concerned about whether or not normal garden variety Hoosiers were able to get to work and get to shop and be able to go about their daily business. So this really posed an interesting challenge for Mr. Pence on his route to the White House. And I have no doubt that moving to a vice presidential nomination gave him some way of kind of, you know, erasing his steps behind him.
And again, I'm speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. And she's the author of Party Politics in America, the Major Political Parties Text, now in its 17th edition. So we've talked a little bit about the earlier theatrics, and if that's the right word to describe how Trump and Pence first got together, with Newt Gingrich flying desperately to Indiana on Sean Hannity's private jet in order to prevent Pence from getting too much traction with Trump, as much as that shows the unseemly ambition of both Pence and particularly Gingrich. It gets worse because last Thursday, apparently, Mike Pence got word that Trump was meeting with his friend Chris Christie, who was lobbying him hard to pick him for vice president. So Pence then went ahead and leaked that he was the nominee. When Trump found out that Pence had leaked that he was the nominee, Trump was furious, and then he had buyer's remorse and second thoughts. And meanwhile, his friend Christie and Gingrich are weighing in, trying to undo the choice of Pence, with Christie leaking and Gingrich leaking to the press that Trump had buyer's remorse about Mike Pence. So these are leaks and counter-leaks. But again, it's swirling around a combination of amateurism, unseemly ambition, and tawdry politics. It's not exactly an auspicious start.
Well, the Trump campaign has always been about Trump and by Trump and for Trump, and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of extensive strategic consultation involved in the campaign. It's just what Trump feels like at the time. And one thing that lends credence to what you're saying is that it was very odd that when Trump introduced Governor Pence, Trump left the stage rather than standing in the back and, you know, doing the approving nodding that would have been expected of a presidential candidate introducing a vice presidential nominee. And as you've mentioned, his Trump's introduction speech for Pence was all about Trump, just as Chris Christie's speech to the Republican National Convention 4 years ago was all about Chris Christie, not about Mitt Romney. It's a real challenge for the Republican Party. The Republican Party for a long time had been very involved in advanced technologies, in applying pretty sophisticated campaigning techniques to be able to get a majority and then maintain it, which we've seen with respect to voter identification laws and a whole series of other things. But the Trump campaign is just stepping away from all that. The Republican National Committee has built a very impressive system of information, big database on voters all over the country and non-voters all over the country. And it's struggled to try to translate that into some practical applications. But it sounds as though Mr. Trump is not interested in any of that, that he's just basically not convinced with ground-level campaigning, and that he believes that having been so effective in gathering so much media coverage that he just overwhelmed his rivals, that that's the way he's going to be able to win the presidency in the fall.
Well, apparently all of this leaking and counter-leaking that was going on between Pence and Christie, et cetera, was driving Manafort, Paul Manafort, the ostensible campaign manager, crazy. The kids apparently wanted Pence, and so did Manafort, to sort of professionalize and and bring in the connections that Pence has to Washington and the House, and also, I guess, by extension, the Christian right. But my sense is that they've already, I think people have exaggerated how much the evangelical vote depends upon whether you pass the evangelical litmus test. I think it's my sense is it's always been a kind of front for right-wing politics, particularly televangelism. And they seem to have settled on Trump in any case. That doesn't seem to bother him, his marriages and his sort of bacchanalian New York lifestyle, along with all of these, the fact that he's an owner of a number of gambling dens, which are by definition sinful. So what's your sense of whether it's going to make any difference? I think, doesn't Trump already have the evangelical vote?
Oh, he clearly does, and so do the Republicans. I think that when we take a look at the data, we see that in exit polls and in public opinion polls, Christian evangelicals have voted Republican by 75 to 80% in 2004, in 2008, in 2012. And now it looks as though, from the most recent poll I saw, Trump has support from about 80% of evangelicals. Now, the Republican candidates during this time were pretty different from one another. I mean, George W. Bush and Mitt Romney and John McCain and Donald Trump. So it seems pretty clear that the relationship is between the evangelicals and the Republican Party, not any one candidate. So I don't think that Mr. Trump needed Governor Pence in order to get evangelical support. There's another factor, however, that Governor Pence was one of the candidates that the Koch brothers organization had felt comfortable with. Apparently, at least they let it be known that there were four or five of the 17 Republican prospective presidential candidates that they were content with, and Pence was one of them. They are not at all content with Donald Trump, and it may be that in addition to Pence's contacts in Washington, that there's been some hope that perhaps the Koch brothers will moderate a bit with respect to their negative reaction to Donald Trump.
Well, of course, that will help Trump a lot, given that he doesn't seem to avail himself of traditional politics in the sense of having state infrastructures and running a campaign and raising the funds. Already, I'm told by a lot of political professionals that Trump has essentially lost the presidency because he simply cannot catch up by neglecting the infrastructure necessary to become president. And my understanding is that you mentioned how the party has a lot of infrastructure, and but much of the money that's been raised has gone to the party, not to Trump, from what I understand, and that the Koch brothers do have an extraordinarily sophisticated database, which would be very, very helpful. So what do you think's going on here? Are they really doing damage control, even on the eve of the convention itself, and making sure they can get as many House members and senators elected? And they don't seem to be committed to Trump.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that, unfortunately, with respect to the Republican National Committee, the ship has already sailed. There's not an awful lot to be done about trying to bring Republican office holders back into the fold. Once you haven't attended the convention, it's going to be very difficult. But I think that those office holders are doing their best to protect themselves, because to the extent that they're identified with Donald Trump, and Republicans are very worried that there's going to be a huge Democratic advertising wave linking Republican candidates to Donald Trump, to the extent to which they are going to be linked to Trump by their own actions, they're going to just be asked all the time, okay, Donald Trump just said this bizarre thing, how do you feel about it? And that's going to take Republican candidates for the House and the Senate and other offices away from their talking points. It's going to hijack the agenda of Republican campaigns all over the country. But nevertheless, I wouldn't be quite so sure that Donald Trump is likely to lose. I think that probably the conditions as they are now, if they remain the same in November, make it more likely that he will lose. But he's certainly only going to be helped by an increase in terrorist incidents. There are an awful lot of people who are Trump supporters who don't seem to be bothered by virtually anything that Mr. Trump says. They are attached to him emotionally. They feel he has some kind of level of anger and power and aggression that they may identify with and feel strong because of. That's not likely to change. And when you consider that Donald Trump is doing as well as he is in the polls, given how hard his campaign seems to have worked to be doing poorly in the polls, it's probably going to be closer than many people expect.
Well, indeed, it's pretty extraordinary that in many polls, Hillary Clinton and Trump are level, and in some cases, Trump's even ahead. And of course, he will get the bounce from the expected bounce, at least that's the conventional thinking, from the convention itself. That's the way it usually works out. But just in closing, Marjorie Hershey, what's your sense of whether that there will be a bounce from this pretty strange array of people that he's got, which is all basically all about him and his family, including, of course, the son who shot the elephant, which is somewhat symbolic given the Republican Party's symbol of the elephant.
Well, the Trump campaign has been a kind of reality TV since the beginning, and I imagine the convention will be the same. Convention bounces aren't what they used to be. They don't necessarily exist at all, and they don't seem to be quite as high in their bounce as they used to be. There have been recent nominees whose convention bounce has been essentially zero. And it's difficult to imagine what this one is going to play out like because it's so hard to envision what this convention is going to look like once it finally gets on the road. It looks as though there's going to be quite a bit of decision-making made at the last minute. So I would be very hesitant to predict what this convention is going to come off like. But if there is no convention bounce, which I think is entirely likely, then we're just going to see a tremendous amount of pressure on Secretary Clinton in the Democratic National Convention. She has a big hole dug for her in terms of very high ratings on untrustworthiness and lying and various other kinds of negative qualities that have hit her very hard and that, of course, are not separable from the fact that she's the first serious woman presidential candidate. And it's really going to be incumbent on the Democrats to be able to reframe the terms on which the United States sees Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Convention to figure out whether or not she's going to be able to take advantage of the problems that Trump has caused for himself or whether or not he's going to manage to get through with it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Marjorie Hershey.
You're most welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. And she's the author of Party Politics in America, the major political parties text now in its 17th edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.